Ever wonder if there's more to the movies you love? Do you like to ponder how they got from A to Z? Who chose the plot twists? Why use those characters? Is there a deeper meaning? We're here to explore those questions and maybe learn a bit along the way. VGB Studios proudly presents The Filmlosophers.
Hello and welcome to another exciting episode of The Filmlosophers, the show that gets into the movies you love and digs a little deeper. I am your host, Eddie Villanueva, and alongside me, as always, is Mr. Chad Streaming Service Riley.
Hey, I like that. I'm always on.
Well, also with us is Spencer Hulu Riley.
He's not even Riley. My last name.
William.
What are you doing? Because it's just
Fail.
Like, that's not my last name. Nobody likes Hulu.
I like Hulu.
What's wrong with you?
Because of the ads. You have to pay extra to get adless.
I pay just as much as I do for Netflix as I do for Hulu, and I don't get ads. Speaking of streaming services, that's going to be the topic of today's discussion, so we're going to get into that and a lot of the controversy that has arisen from certain directors giving their comments about the streaming service. Stick around as we jump into that. But before we do, Chad, take it away.
Come rain or come shine, or massive amounts of cash falling from the sky, the Filmlosophers podcast is presented by Mingle Media TV and VGB Studios, and we'd better get a portion of that plunder if we can make it out alive.
Gotta go to the Andes.
New episodes pop up like new programming on Netflix each Wednesday morning on Spotify, iTunes, Google Play, Stitcher, Libsyn, Player FM, and Audio Boom.
If you want to sound off like Steven Spielberg or just say hello, we'd love to hear from you. Connect with us anytime on Facebook at facebook.com/filmlosophers or on Twitter at twitter.com/filmlosophy101. Finally, when you can't quite decide the next thing to watch on your streaming platform of choice, we've got all the content you could want. With nearly 160 episodes and a few supplements, you should be able to find something that's perfect for you.
Like supplements, like vitamin supplements?
Steroids.
Gotcha. Okay, continue.
Yes, we have podcast steroids. You heard it here first.
Yeah.
Give us a chance to win you over by visiting filmlosophers.com and listen in.
That's right. We got a ton of episodes, a lot of fun stuff for you to listen into, including the episode that we're going to dive into right now. And as we mentioned earlier in the episode, we are going to be talking about streaming services, particularly the big red Netflix. So if you've been around for some time, you know that the streaming services as of late have been kind of the go-to for most entertainment opportunities. It has been some time since the moment the streaming era of entertainment had begun. Netflix, which is an American media service internet company, began in 1997. They fought tooth and nail through the years to emerge as the premier internet streaming service. So every year, the streaming powerhouse actually continues to gain steam, going from sharing content to actually creating content.
Yeah, I remember when they were first like a competitor to Blockbuster Video.
Yeah,
right?
I remember
that. It was like
that.
A mail order DVD service. And
which
then I remember.
Still have.
Yeah, which
you can do that still.
You can still do that. Yeah.
Wow.
And they still get like I believe $7 million in revenue just off of that part alone.
Okay. I remember when they first started switching to streaming like hardcore and I didn't know that it was going to work just because very few places in the world at that time, and this was over a decade ago, but you didn't have strong enough bandwidth to really get through. I remember like you get like 10 seconds in and then like you're waiting for it to buffer and then like work again. And it's remarkable how far technology overall has come with Netflix and all the platforms.
It's true. In 2013, Netflix launched its first three original series, House of Cards, Hemlock Grove, and Orange is the New Black. The streaming service pulled in 31 primetime Emmy nominations for its original shows. In 2017, Netflix won its first Oscar. That service's original content, The White Helmets, won in the Best Documentary Short Subject category. So that was around the first time when Netflix started actually getting awards. That's not to say that that's the first time they've ever been nominated. Because, I mean, even before that, I believe, what was the one that was being shopped around? The Beast of Beast of a Nation or something.
I know what you're talking about.
Which
Beast
had,
of No Nation.
I think it might have been Beast of
Beast
No
of
Nation.
Beast of No Nation, yeah.
Which that one, the only reason why I know it was being campaigned was because we had gotten a screener copy for a friend that we knew who was a member of SAG. Mm-hmm. So,
I remember you guys talking about this a few years ago.
Yeah. So they've been getting nominated and they've been getting attention, but in terms of awarding, this was their first foray into that. Netflix's budget actually skyrocketed. So I was telling some of the guys here before we went on the air, it's crazy because last year alone was this big old hoopla, like they were going on about like, oh, we're going to double the budget that we had the year before for original content. And mind you, in 2017, the budget was around $1.2 billion. They doubled it with $2.6. It was in the ballpark of around $2.6 billion, and they were all going nuts. Netflix just recently announced that they are skyrocketing that budget for original content, not by just doubling it or tripling it. They've skyrocketed it to over $18.6 billion.
That's a gamble.
But no, well, it's true. But because I was thinking the entire time, I'm like, okay, well, that's just like in my mind, production, actors, stuff like that. But Chad was even going as far as saying, well, there's more than just that, because it was actually even in terms of like campaigning and marketing. That's what's all in this budget as well.
Absolutely. I mean, once you create the content, then you want people to watch it.
Yeah.
I mean, you've got to promote it somehow. And yes, there are 200 and some odd million subscribers worldwide. So you'll see it, you know, in your stream feeds. But everyone else, I mean, they market on the internet. They put TV commercials on, you know, over the air or you know, just cable, whatever.
Yeah.
Stations. They do billboards. They do augmented reality experiences sometimes. Mm-hmm. They show up at Comic-Con from time to time. I mean, they've got a lot going on from a marketing standpoint.
And mind you, we are not, you know, we are not separated from the fact that we know Netflix is doing everything it's doing. We all each year have our own accounts. We all frequent Netflix. You may have heard the intro music into this conversation, which happened to be the theme song to one of its more recent popular series. Spencer, would you like to name that series?
That is Stranger Things. I do love me some Stranger Things.
You do, which yes. It was Spencer's choice to utilize that particular theme song. But we are familiar with it. We are very well aware of the fact that this streaming platform is in just about every household around the world nowadays. Like, unless you are in a particular country that does not have such amenities, i.e. like maybe, I don't know, North Korea or somewhere where that kind of stuff is not allowed, I'd say pretty much most households have this streaming service. And it's completely accessible nowadays because, like Chad was mentioning before, internet was not as up to date in terms of the speeds or its availability. And now you can get fast lightning 4G LTE internet speeds with small devices that you just, you know, turn on and have it near your laptop, and it'll stream, you know, wireless internet instantaneously.
Sure. Well, and the other thing that's true about the budget is it's very easy in many ways. Living in America, as we do, it's easy to take an American-centered mindset, but this budget actually pertains to original content produced all over the world in all different languages. I mean, once you start down the thread of original content on Netflix and you watch, like, what was the one that we watched a couple years ago from Brazil?
It was 3%.
3%.
Yes, 3%. So, like, after watching that, suddenly in the feed, you've got all of these other original content options from all sorts of different countries outside of America. So the budget is huge. I mean, that's a gigantic number.
Yeah.
For any company to be investing in content in a single year. But it does encompass literally the entire globe.
Yeah. And you make a great point because of the fact that you think original content, like you said, you don't just think English American content. You have to look broader. You have to think bigger. And we're talking $18.6 billion for creating content all over the world that we may see a portion of it, like that series 3%. that was an opportunity because I guess Netflix thought it was something that could feed into other markets. There are shows, there are films, there are documentaries that don't necessarily speak to the markets that are here in America that aren't shown here. Like, mm-hmm. regionally, they're shown where they're from or what market they're catering to. And that's fine because that's content directed towards them. But thinking about it in the larger sense, like, yeah, okay, $18.6 billion for worldwide content. The numbers begin to seem more reasonable now.
Well, and I would be really interested. They probably have a stat like this, and again, I just don't do my homework, but I would be interested to know, like, how many hours of content per year does that equal? Not consumption, obviously, because if a million people consume an hour, that's a million hours of consumption, but just in terms of the actual time value of the finished products in a year, it still has to be in the thousands of hours between serialized, you know, television show like content and then feature film length or documentary, you know, short film length. When you add all of it up, it's got to be in the multiple thousands of hours
from their
per
own
year
content
that they are creating.
Oh,
from scratch. Yeah, like they're paying for it, they're producing it, distributing it, marketing it, all of it. Like the tally of hours has to be huge.
Apparently, the amount that they released in 2018 was about 1,500 hours of original content.
Well, there you go.
Wow. And that's just, wow, that's not bad.
Yeah, I mean, literally, once they're, I don't know, maybe another year into content creation, I mean, you could literally feed people just Netflix-created content. And you'd never get through it in a year.
Which, I mean, is not a far-off thought. It's not something that's so foreign to where we've been going with streaming services today. I mean, you take a look at what, because we mentioned Spencer Hulu Riley earlier. Hulu itself is creating content on its own that is becoming more and more popular. I'm currently stuck in a series because I keep going back and rewatching certain episodes of Castle Rock, which is a series that is on Hulu that's based on the Stephen King novels and so forth. And it's a great series. The Handmaid's Tale is also a Hulu series that is getting a lot of attention. Freeform is getting a lot of attention. And it seems like I mentioned at the beginning of this episode, streaming services have become probably the prominent choice for most home entertainment opportunities, whether if it's going to a movie, renting a movie, or streaming a movie.
Well, yeah, for good reason, because, like, the nice thing about streaming movies is that you generally get a large selection of just probably stuff you've never seen before, maybe some stuff you have seen before that you'd like to see again. Like, I know they spent, Netflix spent an insane amount of money on Friends alone, and people have been just binge-watching that, so.
The series Friends?
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Oy. To be able to redistribute. The Office is its most successful ever.
It's true, because we've seen it at least a few times.
Yeah, I mean, but it's smart because you draw people in with properties that they recognize, they liked, they want to not have to, you know, pay to buy the entire series on DVD or digital copy or whatever. Yeah. And so they go to Netflix, and then suddenly you've got an open window into the entire world of content.
Yeah, and not just your content. Like we mentioned earlier, we're talking content that is created from filmmakers from around the world sometimes, even.
Totally.
You know, like we were mentioning with the 3%. And you would think, well, that sounds like a swell idea. It sounds like a great idea. There's nothing wrong with that. Who would ever go against that? Well, there's somebody. And kind of the point of this conversation is we wanted to come around to this. And with the last year, this past year marked a milestone for the service by them receiving several nominations and even awards for its feature film, Roma, and the director, Alfonso Cuarón. Controversy pretty much has arisen, however, with one of the most prolific directors of our age, Steven Spielberg. The man has come forward showing his disdain for the idea of recognizing through the Academy these films. It's not so much as recognizing the ability to create films through this streaming service or distribute through this streaming service. His issue was recognizing them through the Academy Awards, awarding them. Essentially, what he said was, once you commit to a television format, you're a TV movie, he had told outlet ITV News. You certainly, if You certainly, if it's a good show, deserve an Emmy, but not an Oscar. I don't believe films that are just given token qualifications in a couple of theaters for less than a week should qualify for the Academy Awards nominations.
That is just such a condescending and pretentious comment.
But if it, well, yes, you're right. You're right. But if you've seen Steven Spielberg's kind of history with film, that's kind of the way he's been. Like, he's very legalistic in the mindset of cinema should be experienced in the cinema, in the theater. Like, if he's making a movie, it should be made to be experienced in this whole, you know, large theater type, you know, this arena type theater, and you should have the music on loud, and it should be shaking your seats, and you should be seeing this with a bag of popcorn. You should be, you know, that's his whole idea.
Yeah, but the problem with that idea is that it's kind of stuck in an era before people had, like, you know, legit home theaters that could rival some, like, you know, movie theaters, especially the crappier ones.
It's true.
Yeah, without like the sticky mess under your shoes or the screaming child in the middle of an R-rated movie who shouldn't even be in the room to begin with.
Or the $7 popcorn.
The $5 small soda. Really, movie theaters?
Like, that's the real robbery here.
Well, and it's interesting for him to come about and say that, especially in an era where it seems to be the most obvious point of exposure for a lot of filmmakers and whatnot. It makes sense, but he wasn't alone, actually, in his thoughts. I mean, shortly thereafter, Dunkirk director Christopher Nolan actually threw in his thoughts about Netflix, calling the streaming giant's release plans, the plans for creating all this content for last year, for 2018, bizarre and, quote, mindless. Now, mind you, he did later apologize to the chief content officer, Ted Sarandos, however, calling his remarks, quote, undiplomatic. But nevertheless, he said it. And I think it's kind of like this purist attitude, if you will, mm-hmm. for most older filmmakers. Like, I don't know if a lot of them carry that. Like, I haven't heard from George Lucas, and George Lucas and Steven Spielberg are like buddies. So I would have assumed like George Lucas would have came out and said, oh, yeah, I agree with Steven. Yeah, you know, just put Jar Jar Binks in his next movie.
George is retired.
No.
Get him up here.
But it's interesting for the fact to see, like, it's an opportunity for filmmakers to come out and actually give their opinions, but somebody to be just so one-sided in this particular arena of not even willing to, like, budge. Like, well, I guess, like, if it's a great movie, I can see the recognition, but... You know, I don't know. This is more of like, yeah, no, you don't deserve to have these nominations. You don't deserve to have these recognitions because of the fact that your medium of how you deliver, if you will, the content that you're giving is on a television or it's in the home. So it should be home-minded type of content, i.e. TV.
Well, and it kind of is, I mean... I understand the perspective of, you know, all the craftsmanship that you put into it. It's meant to be experienced in a certain environment. But let's be honest. Most movie theaters in the world are not that environment. Like,
no.
When you look at... When you see, like, small documentary pieces of, like, a composer working on the soundtrack and the score to a movie, and you see, like... the sound-oriented atmosphere of the recording studio and the playback and all of that, it's like, we don't get that kind of an environment. Like,
no.
I don't care how, like, digital whatever your theater is.
Yeah.
Yes, it can rattle your seat. Yes, it can, like, be a huge, you know, screen, like an IMAX screen that you can't even see across, so what's the point in challenging your eyes to do it? you know, yeah, and that's not poo-pooing. I do enjoy an IMAX theater good sound. But most theaters are not that level of, like, viewing quality experience.
Yeah.
Most of them are, like, hard on your backside seats with screaming people. Popcorn goo and whatever else on the floor.
People talking during the film.
And not enough leg room.
A mild or moderate case of BO that just sort of permeates the space. So to be so auteur about it, it is a little disturbing because I understand that he's advocating for, like, the highest level of quality, but in all honesty, most of us don't experience the highest level of quality, even for movies that do release in the theater.
Yeah.
Now, his comment also is sort of like a slap, you know, because it's, well, they just released these for a couple weeks and then they qualify for the Oscars, and the Oscars are too good for that. You know, I think that there's definitely, he needs to tread carefully.
Yeah.
Because a big part of the subtext of the Oscars discussion every year now is opportunity.
Yeah.
Access to tell the stories that deserve to be told in the first place, to get funding for projects that are outside of the expected or the traditional or whatever.
Yeah.
Then to get them made and distributed, and then to pay I don't know how much money to have them literally campaigned in order to be nominated.
Yeah.
It's not cheap. And it's not just like, oh, well, it's just the best ones that always get in here. No, that's not the way that it works.
Even close.
It's just like politics in a certain way where it's like, no, you have to have the cover charge, essentially. Like, you've got to have a certain amount of financial investment to really be considered. Are there some exceptions? Yes. Typically, like, in, like, the short subject documentary category, or you know, like something like that, that was specifically created for a certain, you know, component that's not feature length, giant budget, you know, or like super pedigree from the writer, director, you know, performers, you know, whatever. But something like Roma, or even something like what we're going to talk about a little bit later, Third Frontier, they don't have any fewer faces, craftsmen working behind the scenes.
Yeah.
They don't have any like lesser pedigree writers, directors, cinematographers, composers, performers, makeup artists, etc.
Like, yeah.
The production value is just as high in some cases, not in all. But in some cases, it's just as high as any other quote-unquote Oscar-worthy film.
Yeah.
And to rule it out on account of its distribution strategy is, I think, a bit short-sighted.
And it's interesting to me, like, from a logistic point of view, the thing he says when he states, you know, that you're putting out for less than a week, films that have been out for less than a week shouldn't qualify yet. There is an age-old practice in Hollywood for filmmakers to ensure that they get nominated or they can campaign for a film for the year of by making sure they do a limited release
totally
the week before New Year's.
Totally.
And I was 100%. Thinking about, I'm like, they've been doing that for ages. And I'm like, well, I wonder. And so I looked, and sure enough, Steven Spielberg's 2018 film, which was released in 2018, but because he did a limited release the last week of December for The Post. It was released, it was done a limited release in 2017. So,
yeah.
But it went wide in January 12th.
Afterward.
Mm-hmm. So it's like, isn't that kind of the same thing? He's getting attention for the film only being in theaters for
just enough to qualify.
Exactly. And then they do the wide release later on after the fact, which we all know movies done earlier in the year don't usually get as much attention because they're considered not as grand or not as well, you know, established as like, oh, these are Oscar winners, these are whatever. But still, it's kind of like it's kind of hypocritical in my mind to say that when knowing that Hollywood has been doing this for years, years and years.
Well, and let's be honest, I mean, Spielberg himself was a disruptor in the industry.
Oh, no doubt.
When he was first getting his start. I mean, it's ironic, I think, that someone who has advocated so strongly and effectively for his take on creating entertainment products is now criticizing a different approach.
Yeah.
And saying, well, you know, just because of essentially the channel it's on, it doesn't rank. I mean, it's a very bourgeois kind of thing to say. Which is surprising because he's always been very populist.
It's true.
Like, I mean, blockbusters are blockbusters in large part thanks to Steven Spielberg.
Yeah.
I mean, it's something that, like, Jaws was one of the first movies that was even given that adjective.
Yeah, completely.
Or now, I don't know. It depends on how you use it. But it's, you know, whatever. I was a former English teacher. I'm getting in my own head. But, like, that's what he's known for in some ways is doing something different, bigger, more dramatic, you know, whatever. Granted, yes, in a movie theater. That was the option. A movie theater, a stage play, or a television set.
Yeah.
And he did movies and made a ton of money. And most of these movies that he's ever made, like, people really like them. I like most of them.
Yeah.
But now, I don't know. It's like he's an elder statesman. And so he has a voice in the room and he deserves to have that voice. But people who are taking sort of the same approach in the modern day that he took 40 years ago are suddenly like, I don't know. It's like the Grey Poupon commercial.
Yeah.
It's like, nose in the air. You're like, I'm being chauffeured around. Like it really hits as, you know, very bourgeois.
Well, go ahead.
Oh, well, I was going to say it's kind of weird because, like, okay, so, you know, back in the 70s or so, like,
when you were alive. Yeah.
Gotcha. Yeah, I was alive back then. Like, I could see this argument making sense because, like, you know, when you put things on TV, like, that was back when you had to, like, format things for TV.
Mm-hmm.
But TVs are really different now. Like, they're the same aspect ratio. You're not losing something when you're converting down anymore. So I don't, a while back, this probably had, like, some water as an argument, but I don't think it has nearly as much as it used to.
No, I agree completely. I used to hate full screen movies. Like, you can't see. What is he looking at? What is off to the right? And thankfully, even after the fact, almost a year later after his comments, Netflix did come up in Twitter and did respond, as well as other people. Other people have come to the aid and defense of Netflix, but Netflix themselves have actually posted on Twitter on the 3rd of March saying, "We love cinema. Here are some things we also love. Access for people who can't always afford or live in towns without theaters. Letting everyone everywhere enjoy releases at the same time and giving filmmakers more ways to share art. These things are not mutually exclusive." Mm-hmm. And I think that speaks, that's a very professional, proper, and still punch in the face of, you know, a response to what Steven Spielberg said. Because it's true. As art continues to evolve and you have this medium that has gone from, you know, oh, filmmaking and movies, that's all like a glamorous type thing. That's all stuff that's like far off and only in Hollywood. Myself and Chad, because I know we've had conversations with certain film critics from here in Sacramento.
Sure.
And we've had a lot of conversations with some of the older ones. And you hear some of their stories and they'll tell you stories like, oh yeah, I remember back in the 70s and early 80s, they used to fly us to, you know, San Francisco, and we would go and they would come and send a helicopter and we would go and fly to San Francisco and they would give us lunch and then we would sit down and do a press junket with the cast and crew and we would talk and blah, blah, blah. And now, now there's like a mob of like 300-400 people that are waiting outside of the same screening that we're about to go into, and we get to go into the screening, but then it becomes like a mad rush of a riot where everybody has access to it now. Which is fine, because that's the transition, that's kind of the evolution of the industry right now. They want more opinions, they want more eyes on it, they want things like that. We mentioned the other day when we were talking about Us, how there was that special screening back in December for this unknown film, this unnamed film, and it had a ton of people go into it and see it, but nobody could talk about it because stipulations, but that was accessible to the public. You know, it's things like that that's showing the evolution, if you will, of the industry. And I think this is one of those opportunities for the world, as well as like people like Steven Spielberg, to begin to see like why that transition is happening, why that evolution is being made.
It's kind of like, I mean, do you, access is a big topic and it's a worthy topic. I mean, do you not deserve to know what the Mona Lisa even looks like unless you can pay to go to the Louvre in France?
Yeah.
You know, like, do you not deserve to access quote-unquote fine art? It's not my favorite painting. I don't know what everybody is so excited about it for, but...
She doesn't have any eyebrows, you know, Chad. That's what it is.
But anything like that, I mean, is... That's one of the things that's so appealing about somebody like Banksy, right? Because it's like, nope, I'll just do something really compelling and provocative and whatever on the side of a mailbox or the side of a building, or I'll make it and then burn it right in front of you. You know, it's a statement, you know?
Yeah.
And I think it's a really interesting thing. Not that film and fine art are necessarily the same, but they're not totally different. They're both art forms. So, you know, it is a bit disturbing. You know, it's one thing. I want to be careful to not put words
in
Spielberg's mouth. He's not saying people don't deserve to go to movies or like he's just, he has a certain expectation for what deserves to qualify for an Academy Award.
Mm-hmm. He's wagging his finger essentially at the Academy, saying, you shouldn't, you know, pointing his finger at them. You shouldn't be looking at them as an actual film. You should be seeing them as what I believe they are, which they are TV films. So they should be getting Emmys. You know, he's more so pointing his finger at the people who are awarding, which sadly, I don't know if you guys read this, but sadly, it sounds like there was some influence from him for these last Academy Awards. Pretty much. There was apparently word that there was an opportunity that this film could have, that Roma itself could have actually won Best Picture. But the Academy members had already priorly met with Spielberg, and several voters anonymously admitted that they intentionally voted against Roma because they hated the idea of a Netflix movie winning Best Picture after sharing Spielberg's disdain for Netflix. Mm. And that's sad because... That shouldn't be the case. Like, it should not be like, oh, well, you're... Because it kind of goes back to, like, the caste system type of thing. Like, oh,
totally.
You're from this class of people, or you're from that family. No, we don't allow that family to even come within 100 yards, or what is it, their meters. So, 100 meters of with our property. It's like, it shouldn't be... There should never be any, like, asterisk, you know, stipulations for submitting a film to... an Academy, you know, nomination, things like that, when it comes to these types of recognition. Like, if you're a filmmaker, if you're going through all the proper channels, like if you're a SAG director, if you're doing this, if you're, you know, making sure you're following all proper protocol, blah, blah, blah. Once you create the product, there still shouldn't be any more stipulations of like, oh, well, you know, you did put this on Hulu, and just so you know, we don't really consider films from Hulu to kind of be real movies. I mean, you could totally put in for an Emmy. I mean, totally go for it. But it's ridiculous, in all honesty. And to find that, because I had just read this article today, to find out that he had even that kind of influence, I mean...
Yeah, that's a bit upsetting.
It is upsetting. Like, not that... So, yes, we've talked about Roma on the episode, and I may have been the only person who actually enjoyed it on the episode.
Okay, but like, it's got a lot of artistic style.
Yeah, no
I'll
doubt.
Give it that.
No doubt. But the fact that it didn't win Best Picture, not based on its own merits or lack of, but because someone of a certain like standard within the industry, someone who has a certain position within the industry, came in and was like, do you really want to do that? Do you really want to do that? Like, do you really want to do that?
Well, and if something was, let's say, an exceptional feature-length film released on HBO, should it not be considered for the Academy Awards?
I think it should.
Because, yeah. I mean... Essentially, you start drawing the line in one place, and then other people will start trying to move the line, right? And I'm thinking specifically about the most recent that I can come up with, even though I know there are more recent ones. But I remember, like, when I was growing up, something that really struck me was the film Life is Beautiful. Roberto Benigni, like, his passion, his excitement and enthusiasm, like, that was, yes, it was... released in cinemas, released in movie theaters, But it's an Italian film. Yeah. You know, so it's like, well, does it, if we don't want to count Netflix as a distribution option, then you know where do you draw the line for, well, yes, you can get best foreign picture, but not best picture because you're not distributed on the highest quality American movie theater, you know, platform or whatever. And it was. I mean, Life is Beautiful did release, you know, globally, but it's a phenomenal film, you know. Roma was not my cup of tea.
True.
But it was very much like an Academy Award positioned film.
Yeah, it had that feel to it.
Totally. I mean, it's the cinematography alone was the highest level, even though I almost fell asleep a few times in the movie. But like, it was very clearly like almost auteur level of filmmaking.
Yeah.
You know, so do you, well, apparently they did disqualify it informally behind the scenes.
Yeah.
For being really a contender for Best Picture.
Which is really annoying because it feels like someone walked into a room and then was like, what are all these peasants doing in this room? Get them out! That's what peasants. It sounds like.
Yeah. No, it does. It definitely has that ring to it.
Yeah. And mind you, yes, so there is obviously two sides to every argument, and I'm certain, because I know Chad is doing a really great job at trying to be careful as to how to present possibly the perspective or the mindset or the logic that Steven Spielberg is taking when he's making this statement.
Yeah, I hate when people are taken out of context entirely.
I totally get it. It's interesting. Going back to what I was saying earlier about the evolution of like just entertainment altogether, I mean, we see what is transpiring within these last few years, at least. Like, in the last 2 to 3 years, you look at some of the content that has been coming out of every streaming service that is there, or even the ones that are popping up because of the popularity of streaming services, and there's, like, great content being thrown out left and right of not just shows, but even film. And going through, like, we've even done our fair share of giving attention to certain films put out by Netflix, original content, mind you. We did The Little Prince, which I thought was actually a really great episode we did, because that was one of our first ones within our first 25 episodes. It was our 23rd episode, Lesson 23.
Which was not Netflix produced. They
distributed.
They took over distributing when Paramount fell through in the North American market.
But it's still technically branded as,
we wouldn't have seen it
if it wasn't for
Netflix picking it up and giving it to us, essentially. Mm-hmm. And it was very well made.
Yeah.
I mean, stylistically, very unique. Claymation and CGI at the same time, back and forth.
Mm-hmm.
Fun story, yeah.
And it's interesting how the progression of films that we've reviewed through the years from Netflix have kind of upped in terms of some of their production quality, or even their production value in terms of actors, performers. I mean, it's no longer just like, oh, well, this person, and maybe you'll recognize this voice and maybe you'll recognize that voice, to full-on actors and performers who are doing feature-length films in theaters doing this stuff as well. We did the film How It Ends, which had Forrest Whitaker. Everybody knows Forrest Whitaker. Extinction, which has Michael Peña, the funny, fast-talking Latino in Ant-Man and Ant-Man and the Wasp. Even Kin, which, well, not so much Kin. Michael B. Jordan is in the film, spoiler alert, but he's not till the tail end.
Yeah. I mean, I do think it says something. We are a film-oriented podcast, and this is the 7th episode in our run of 157, counting this one. This is the 7th episode that we focused heavily on Netflix.
Yeah.
Which, I mean, a decade ago, who'd have thunk?
Yeah. No doubt.
Yeah.
Because, I mean, you look at a lot of them and you think, oh, just series or, you know, episodic series, or you think things like that coming out. Like one of the ones that Spencer mentioned a little bit ago, one of his favorite series that's out there is on Netflix, and it's a Netflix original, to be specific, by the Duff brothers, I believe.
Yep.
And that series is just gaining steam as they're heading into season three. So that's...
Well, and I think that Spielberg wouldn't argue there, nor would Nolan, because those are serialized TV format properties, you know, Stranger Things or Orange is the New Black or, you know, any of that. I mean, it is a TV show versus a movie that may or may not be worthy of Oscar consideration. Now, Nolan's comments are more interesting to me. Both in terms of what he said and in the reversal, because, you know, calling their content strategy mindless and then reversing and saying, you know, that was actually undiplomatic of me.
Yeah.
I mean, it's just sort of like, you could easily, Dunkirk, which we really enjoyed, like, it's mostly a sound movie.
Oh, completely.
Like, it's a completely different experience. So somebody could say, well, that was kind of a junky way of doing a movie, because movies are meant to be visual. And you limited the visual frame every chance you got in order to produce an emotional response. And I think your strategy was mindless there. You know, like, it's, you know, beauty is in the eyes of the beholder.
Oh, totally. I'm trying to find when...
I do appreciate that he sort of retracted somewhat, you know, his comments and said, you know, that wasn't very diplomatic of me to say. No true artist, you know, it's sort of like the golden rule, right? Like, you don't want people saying that kind of stuff about you when you did have an intent.
Yeah.
Whether or not the audience understood, you did something with intention.
Very true. And mind you, even as of late, obviously the recent, like we mentioned earlier, Roma, directed by Alfonso Cuarón, won several awards, including Best Director, Best Foreign Film, and even in the most recent of releases, you got Triple Frontier, which houses a stellar cast of characters, like stellar cast of performers. You got people from like Oscar Isaac to Ben Affleck to Charlie Hunnam. I mean, you got substantial characters in this one, and it's not just like your short little, you know, 1.5 hour long films. You're talking like almost 2 hours long. I think it is 2 hours.
Sure. I mean, and it definitely is. I mean, to kind of bring it back to the cinema discussion, this movie could have been released in movie theaters, and it would have been at least marginally successful. So the fact that it was distributed on Netflix, I think, is really interesting.
Yeah.
Because it does have the cast and the overall tone and vibe of something that could succeed more than other things that we've seen in the cinema.
Yeah, it's true, and it's a really gut-wrenching type of film. Like, it's a gritty film. It's what you would expect from almost like a Tom Clancy-esque type of story. But it's a really great movie, and we'll try to review it soon. But essentially, I guess the question goes as to, like, looking at the perspective from Spielberg, what would you guys say is his kind of point of view on this? Do you think he sees Netflix and streaming services as an opportunity to reach like a broader audience, or do you think that he sees it as a narrower way to experience pretty much an age-old tradition?
I feel like he feels like the Netflix model is an inferior experience to his own method of like releasing films in cinema. That's at least what I could gather from the way he expressed his comments.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It's interesting because you think a lot of these older generation directors, you think a lot of these individuals who have been in Hollywood long enough creating these fantastical worlds. I mean, Steven Spielberg is no stranger to creating incredible worlds. Knowing how future plans out and how the world continues, you would think that this type of mindset wouldn't be too far off from like, okay, this is where we're going, because I've dreamt at one point that this is something we could do. Why can't the real world move into it? Like, it's one of those types of mindsets I'm just trying to wrap my head around, you know?
Well, like, as a species, we're actually really bad at dealing with change. And I think that's kind of what's happening here, is that the times are changing and some people want to poo-poo the new thing. Which, you know...
Poo-poo the new thing.
Yeah, basically.
I like that saying. Poo-poo the new thing.
Well, and the other thing to keep in mind with regard to the Academy Awards, I mean, the public doesn't vote on those.
No.
Correct.
It's all behind closed doors.
So, I don't, like, having more people see it on Netflix and or Hulu or Amazon Prime or, you know, whatever, Apple Plus,
yeah.
Steven.
Apple Plus. Yeah, let's talk about Apple. Why is he on Apple Plus? It's like, I'm doing this thing. And then, like, he's coming down on streaming services. Although I think what he is doing is more of a television
episodic
series.
Yeah. It's a mini series or a series or something. Yeah, so it would qualify.
Nitpicking.
So he kind of, you know, CYA, he covered his own behind because he's like, well, sure, they still deserve Emmy consideration, but not Academy Awards. Like, oh, do they? Because where do you draw the line?
Yeah, and that's completely weird to me as well because it's you would think if you have such a strong opinion about it, you're going to want to distance yourself from the opportunities of like showing, oh, well, I don't believe in that one per se, but I'm still with everybody else. Because it seems almost very narrow-minded of like, well, that movie shouldn't have got it because of that streaming service. And it's gaining steam and we need to stop it. But just so you know, because this is my own other investments, non-related, I'm going to be a part of this. I'm going to be doing something. So, streaming service for the world, yay.
Yeah, with Oprah and Jennifer Aniston. Like, look at who's surrounding you. Come on.
I don't know. I just...
Well,
I
didn't they have to sell off DreamWorks? He's probably just steamed about it. Because he was one of the primaries there. He's probably still got shares or something. But I'm pretty sure they had to sell it to, like, Universal or something, didn't they?
I think so, yeah. DreamWorks went to...
So, Hulu's got it. I mean, Comcast owns all of that.
And this kind of leads to like the last question of the conversation, which I mean is just, in all honesty, what does the future hold for Hollywood and cinema? I mean, Chad was mentioning about kind of the dilapidated state of some theaters. Not every theater looks as clean and pristine as maybe your local IMAX. Does that mean that it's going to be getting less and less attention, which means less and less attention will result in less and less profits, which means less and less opportunities to showcase the bigger and more prominent films because they can't afford them. And that leads to closing down and so forth. I mean, is that the future of what we have? Or do you guys think that maybe there's still a possibility of a balance? Or because it's for me, in all honesty, I don't know. Like, I'm thinking about it, and as I'm outwardly processing what I'm thinking, it almost feels like, for me personally, I love the idea of going to the movies. I love the idea of getting up, getting ready, getting into the car, meeting up with friends, driving to the theater, getting popcorn, sitting down, talking amongst ourselves, laughing at the ridiculousness of previews, and watching the movie.
And shushing small children.
And shushing babies.
All of the babies.
All the babies. But I mean, those are experiences like I enjoy. Like, we wouldn't know that I shush babies if we weren't in a movie theater.
I would argue maybe I shouldn't know that about you. Just throw that out there.
Hey, I'm just saying. Like, I was thinking about it earlier. I'm like, one of my worst movie experiences happened in a movie theater because somebody smelled like hot dogs when I was watching Robert Zemeckis' Castaway. And I remember it very prominently because I was there with my parents and my grandma, and my grandma kept saying, "Oi, que cochino, oi, que cochino." And I'm like, "Grandma, shh."
Yeah, I don't remember the movie, but we actually, growing up, we were not allowed to get concessions because they were so expensive.
It's insane.
I mean, ridiculous, even then, and now they're even worse. But in my hometown, in Indiana, we had a movie theater, had two screens, probably seated about 100 people in each theater, each screen. And one summer, we were all there in the movie theater, and the family that sat behind us had just come from the 4-H fair. Dad raised and showed livestock, and his boots smelled of it. And as an apology, he got us all candy and popcorn and soft drinks, and we had never had any of that in the movie theater before because it was just too much of an expense.
Yeah.
And so, but that was his way of apologizing. So in spite of how terrible the smell was, it was like, oh, but now we have this more typical movie-going experience with all the sugar and salt and whatever. But it was very pungent in that theater, and that's not very pleasant.
You know, I think that's probably something that Steven Spielberg probably hasn't had to deal with, is like an actual movie theater experience that everyone else has to go through versus whatever he does.
Yeah.
And probably like a private like experience.
Probably because he has a huge theater in his own home, more than likely.
Yeah, most likely. Like, that's not what everyone else has.
Like, it's like a massive, huge theater with one seat in the center.
Like, going to the movie theaters can get really expensive. And like, when you're comparing the price of, should I go to the movies or buy a whole month of Netflix for almost the same price?
Practically about the same price.
Yeah, that's like kind of a, this is why people don't go to the movies as much.
Now, mind you, that doesn't, like, still, some of my, because this goes back to the outward processing type thing of myself, some of my most favorite experiences, though, however, with movies and with film have been in theaters. Like, I was there front, well, not front row, but in the midst of everybody else when I went to go see the Force Awakens. The night it opened, with a whole ton of other people who were all dressed up. Like, it's, there's a different kind of ambiance, if you will, of people who go to see like a Marvel film they want to see, and then people who go to see a Star Wars film, because Star Wars fanatics, they come in all ages. Like, you'll see them from young to old, all over the place, and they'll come in, probably prominent businessman who was just wearing a business suit shows up in a Yoda outfit and will be ready to start quoting everything from Yoda, like, everything. Just
oh, is that a direct quote?
That was a direct quote. Exactly. Frank Oz, don't hurt me. But, you know, being in that experience and being with those people and every step of that film, every beat of that film just drew everybody at the edge of their seat all the way to the very end when you see, spoiler alert, mind you, if you haven't seen it by now, then that's your problem, where Han Solo gets stabbed through the chest by his own son, and everybody just like a whole wide sweeping gasp in the entire theater, and there were tears, and I was crying. I was like, oh my God, it's Han Solo, you know. But it was that experience, like that communal experience that I had with everybody else. It was powerful, and I can't take that away from my experiences of going to the movie. So it kind of scares me, but I'm also still excited at the same time of what the prospects show for the future of what we're going to be seeing in like 5, 10, maybe 15 years down the road in entertainment.
True, but at the same time, when you think of like, you know, an Oscar-worthy Best Picture nominee.
Yeah.
Many of them are not that communal experience.
No.
You know, like, Star Wars doesn't get nominated for Best Picture. There's sort of this overall bias. True. We saw it in this year's Academy Awards. They almost created a Best Popular Movie category.
Ooh, people would have been mad.
And it was primarily Academy people who didn't want that, right? Yeah. But then you also had Black Panther in the Best Picture category, not with any chance of winning the category, but still, yeah, I mean, true. It was a big deal when Lord of the Rings was in the Best Picture category.
Yeah.
It was a big deal because there's this weird sense of like, well, certain genres don't belong there.
Yeah.
You know, and it's just like, get over yourself.
It's true.
I mean, what is the value of the award if you automatically mentally disqualify something because the masses enjoy it?
Oh, yeah.
It needs to be more exclusive than that.
Get these peasants out of here.
I mean, it is. And on point.
I love that. Thank you. Thank you. That
you know, but great. It is. There's this general bias against certain types of movies. You know, does a Sharknado film ever stand a chance?
No.
Maybe.
Not even close. Which, it's interesting that you say that, because like the whole genre, you know, ousting kind of thing, because I've always seen that with one of my favorite genres, which is horror. Mind you, there's not many horror films who have been actually mentioned or even recognized as worthy enough to be anything outside of special effects, because that's usually what they get, just special effects or sound design. But then, I mean, with kind of like with what happened with Black Panther this past year,
Get Out for me was not only a very recognizable thing to be nominated for, but the fact that it actually got attention as a horror film, as a psychological horror film, that like just rang all the bells for me. I'm like, yes, because this is exactly what other horror films that you guys overlooked, because you know, Robert Zemeckis was doing this year, or you know, Martin Scorsese was doing this year, or Steven Spielberg was doing that this year. Recognizing a lot of the opportunities and the genius behind a lot of these films, that's part of that, like you were saying earlier, opportunities, those looking at those moments where you can look past your own, you know, blindness, if you will, past the blinders, and see what's actually out there. Not just seeing the genre, or not just seeing the streaming platform, or not just seeing, you know, what channel it was on, but to actually recognize it for the medium that it is, the content that it is, the way it is received by people as movies, as film, as art, as somebody's message to the outside world.
Well, and if you kind of automatically disqualify certain entertainment products that we call movies, from the running, at some point over time, unintentionally maybe, you will devalue the award altogether.
Yes.
You know, I mean, what is an award show actually doing? In the best light, it's rewarding exceptional work.
Mm-hmm.
Heart, yeah. Creativity, passion, art, you know, all of that. But at its most basic, it's people from the same industry patting each other on the back.
Oh, no doubt.
Yeah. You know, so it's no different than like Business of the Year in like the Chamber of Commerce Awards or something. You know, like it's just, it's more promoted. It's more seen, but it's not, you know, it's like any other award ceremony. And again, at its heart, the heartbeat is to reward exceptional, you know, performances, quality, you know, whatever. So. Yeah. There is definitely a good side, but at the same time, how many awards does Hollywood throw for itself?
Too many.
Way too many.
Like, so many.
Yeah.
So, if you, in one of those ceremonies, the Academy Awards happens to be the most highly regarded, and also, it's been televised the longest and whatnot, but if you write rules that don't make sense, then at some point, you're going to end up diminishing the value of the award and the ceremony altogether, and people will not be afraid to create a new ceremony. Like, okay, well, then we'll go and make awards over here that do include commercial production and music videos and virtual reality and augmented reality and what, yeah. Like, whatever. Like, the medium is changing and evolving every day. You know, so as with anything involving change, if you don't go with it, eventually it will outpace you.
Yeah.
Well, I feel like they're in danger of that already happening because, really, before I joined this podcast, I'd never bothered to watch the Academy Awards.
It's true. We've heard the mini stories.
Well, because like normally it's just I had that impression before I even watched it. It's just a bunch of Hollywood types congratulating themselves,
yeah.
And like movies that like I actually think are pretty good will just be ignored and not like even really considered.
Yeah.
And when you have that kind of impression, like it's not surprising that viewership is going downhill year after year. It's because you've kind of set up like this own your like own world where people just don't want to be a part of it because it feels like you're being just so hoity-toity exclusive that no one wants to be a part of your party.
Hoity-toity.
I haven't heard that word in a while. Thank you, Spence.
Yeah, you're welcome. I have all the best 1920s words.
I was gonna say I'm gonna have to keep that one in the pocket. The hoity-toity,
highfalutin,
hoity-toity.
Highfalutin.
Yeah, I think that's one of the bigger questions, I guess, for what is to be the future. I mean, yes, there is already part of that step to move away from continuing to feed into that, you know, machine that is the Academy Awards and being able to recognize the bigger overarching kind of goal, which is if you're going to do a Best Picture, you know, award, let it be because there are people who actually enjoyed these movies nominate for these things. And mind you, there are awards shows that actually do this. They do pull from larger sources of opinions, whether if it be like the BAFTAs, which pulls from a lot of film critics from around the United States, to even something like the People's Choice Awards, which is directly from a conglomerate of surveys that it's done out there. There are opportunities for these types of things to be looked at and measured and actually seen. And I think the Academy Awards is one of those opportunities where maybe recognizing that the system that is currently in play is only doing more harm than good, and putting so much power within the hands of the people who are already holding so much more other power in the industry itself is probably not the best thing you want to do. On top of that, giving somebody like Steven Spielberg the gas can to add more fuel to that and say, well, because I've been doing this for X amount of years, I believe my opinion holds weight and I think X, Y, and Z. And you should listen to me because
I'm Steven Spielberg.
You sound like Optimus Prime.
I mean, I think everybody's entitled to their own opinion.
True.
He definitely has the clout and the experience to let his voice be heard. It's just going to be interesting to see how much weight that mindset continues to carry, in the evolving landscape of the entertainment world.
Yeah.
I mean, who knows? Netflix itself might go away in the next 10 years because some other type of technology takes over.
If they go away, it's going to be because they spent too much on content and ran out of money.
Well, not just that, because in the same article that I looked at the other day or this morning, it also says that there's going to be another price hike for Netflix because of the fact that they're spending so much money on original content. You think about it. The reason why Netflix was so accessible and so widely used was because the price of it, like Spencer had mentioned earlier, was comparable to that of a single movie ticket at the theaters nowadays. Yeah. Now you're looking at, okay, well, that's not just a movie ticket, but that's a movie ticket and a large popcorn. You know, you're now equating it to stuff that's like, I think I'm good on Netflix. In fact, I think I'm going to cancel this one and start paying more attention to my, I don't know, Freeform, my
Freeform. Why was that the first one?
That's one of many that's coming up. I mean, they have one of those Marvel series, Cloak and Daggers on.
Yeah,
Freeform, Cloak and Dagger. You look at Hulu. Hulu's got, like I mentioned earlier, Castle Rock. And they got a bunch of other The Handmaid's Tales. They got a bunch of other content.
Well, Disney Play or Disney Plus Disney or whatever Plus, it's called.
That's what it is.
You know, launching this year at some point.
It's coming for all your dollars.
Yeah. You've got CBS All Access. Nothing I mean, like, you've got so many that already are running their own. Like, they're doing to streaming platforms what they've done with cable.
Yeah.
Which depends on how much you're willing to pay.
We're cord cutting from not only everything else, but Netflix now, too. So, but that about wraps up another awesome episode of The Film Philosophers. We'd love to hear your thoughts on this. How do you feel about Steven Spielberg's comments? Do you believe him? Do you agree? Do you not agree? Do you think Spencer should change his last name to Riley? Let us know on our Facebook page at facebook.com/filmphilosophers or on our Twitter page at twitter.com/filmphilosophy101. My brain literally just paused and went on a vacation for a quick second.
You were just like building the suspense.
My brain was being a Windows computer. It kind of did that reboot, the twirling umbrella thing going on. Yeah, Spencer, I said it.
Okay.
I said it. We'd love to hear from you. Let you know of a couple upcoming weekend releases. You got Hellboy with Sheriff Hopper. you got Little, and you got Missing Link, starring Hugh Jackman, Zach Galifianakis, and Zoe Saldana. Like a stop-motion film. So you got to check those three out, and let us know what you get to go see. We'd love to hear your thoughts. But this was an interesting conversation, and mind you, like we said, one of the great things about movies and the art of movies and the art of cinema is that it's an ever-evolving industry. If it was the same way as it was when it first started, we would still be seeing 5-minute black and white films with no sound and just utter nonsense of creativity where not much is being done. You know, it's an interesting and evolving industry, and thankfully it's going to continue to evolve. Let's just hope that everybody else evolves with it.
Yeah.
So that's my thought. I don't know.
But like I said, this wraps up another awesome episode. And if you want to check out more, check out our website at filmlosophers.com. So from all of us here at the Filmlosophers, I'm Eddie.
I'm Chad.
I'm Spence.
Class dismissed.